Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So we do a number of experiences at the winery. We do a five Bordeaux red varietal tasting. Mm-hmm. And for me, when we remodeled the winery in 2012, I wanted to ensure that you can sit down and you can taste wines side by side. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, for me, is the best way to understand what you as an individual like to taste and what you like. And mm-hmm. I think in any phase of wine knowledge, a quest for knowledge or experiences, the more you know about your own palate and what you like and how to describe that or how that wine is different, the greater your experience will be each time you have a wine. And if someone comes in and they don't like any of our wines, well, that's great. Now you know something about your own palate. You don't like dry wines, or you want wines that are, you know, a different style. So I think we do a tasting with white wines. That's Sauvignon Blanc and stainless steel. Sauvignon Blanc with some barrel fermentation. Sauvignon Blanc with Semillon in it. Semillon on its own. Chardonnay with oak. Chardonnay without oak. Because so often people say, oh, I don't like white wine.
Yeah.
But what they don't like is perhaps a wine that's a white wine that's a little sweeter, or perhaps it's a white wine that has a lot of American oak and malolactic fermentation. And that's what they don't like. So it's kind of fun because then you can say, oh, I like Sauvignon Blanc with a little Semillon in it. Well, Duckhorn Sauvignon Blanc almost always has, you know, about 20% Semillon in it. Mm-hmm. So we can say, hey, if that's the style you like and you don't have our Vertu on the list, here are some other options and things to tell your local wine merchant, things to tell your sommelier that you know about what you like. Or I like stainless steel Sauvignon Blanc from a warmer climate. Yeah. I like, you know, or maybe you don't like ours and you prefer a stainless steel Sauvignon Blanc from the New Zealand climate with a little, you know, grippier acidity. Mm-hmm. So I think those things are really important. So we do different tastings like that. So you can say, oh, I really love Cabernet Franc, or I, you know, like a red blend that is Cabernet dominant. But I think those things are important. We do a Cabernet collector's tasting of our different Cabernets. We do a blending. You can blend your own Vertu with wow. Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc. That's a fun way to kick off a girls' weekend and all come and do a little blending together. But there's the goal is to enjoy the wine and to discover something new, either about yourself or about winemaking or just what you enjoy, and most of all to share a glass of wine with friends. I mean, people don't come to Napa Valley to not enjoy themselves. So we want to be sure you have fun, and the wines are delicious.
Indeed, and what you're describing is actually a ton of fun, especially the custom blending. And I took a look at the bottle, and it's silkscreen, and it's so beautiful. You know, that alone is worth it, just aesthetically, let alone the fact that you will experience kind of a hands-on version of what it's like to participate in the winemaking process. But the empowerment piece of the way you described is that it's really learning about yourself, discovering your own palate. And I'm sitting here thinking how great that would be to scale it. This industry can be intimidating to the consumer just from the point of view of so many choices and not understanding what you like versus what you don't like. Mm-hmm. And so many of us, particularly in the media, profess to try to take the confusion out of it, but I think we actually had to most of the time. So what a great way of addressing it. And certainly it's very much the culture at your winery as you describe it.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, all of us taste to learn something because we all taste regularly, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fun to taste blind because sometimes we're surprised, but it's also fun to taste through and just having that ability to go back and forth between the wines and say, gosh, this wine I like best on its own, but when I have this cheese with it, it's a whole new experience mm-hmm. for me. Like our Vertu, to me, I always want to have it with food. Mm-hmm. I think it's just such a fantastic food wine that to me it always shines with a crab cake or something mm-hmm. you know, equally delicious. And with our you know, Napa Estate Sauvignon Blanc, I am happy to just sip that while I'm mm-hmm. making dinner and, and enjoy it for on its own. But we try to create things that are fun to note. It's great with this pairing. It's wonderful on its own, and sort of look at the nuances of the food and wine pairings. You know, we have a fantastic chef, Todd Kawachi. He's amazing, and we have about an acre and a half of produce here, and we have over 1,200 fruit trees at Dollarhide.
Wow!
So we have a lot of wonderful fresh things to work with, and we do a veggies and vino pairing mm-hmm. with what's fresh in the garden today, and how do we enhance that with the wines. And you know, a lot of that is about layering the flavors,
yeah,
right, to match the layers of flavor in the wine.
So it sounds like a complete experience. People yeah. that come here, they never want to leave, do they? From the wine and the food and
well,
the
company.
Well,
that's what happened to me.
I could see that. I'm debating whether or not I really need to go home. it sounds like you drink a fair amount of St. Cypri wines in your house. Is there anything else in your cellar, you know, that we should talk about?
There are a lot of other things in the cellar. I do love champagne, and I love, I think that there's so many great small grower champagnes coming in yes. to the U.S. today, mm-hmm. and I've been very much enjoying the extra brutes and the zero dosage champagnes yeah. from a lot of the smaller growers. So that's always a staple in our house.
Excellent.
You know, if it's Friday and there's no champagne, something is wrong or someone's ill.
Oh my. I
love Barolos and Barbarescos. I really enjoy a lot of different Italian wines, and of course Burgundy, what's not to love. Mm. And Pinot Noir. My friend Claire Carver and her husband have a wonderful property in Oregon called Big Table Farm. I just adore their Pinot Noir. It's absolutely delicious. I think there's some wonderful wines coming out of Oregon right now, and I just don't have enough of them in my cellar at the moment.
Wow. Has there been any bottles specifically that just really stood out? You know, not necessarily one epiphany bottle, but something that is so memorable that you kept thinking and going back to it over and over mm-hmm. again.
Well, when I was first tasting wines, I was at school at Davis, and I went home and had wine with my parents, and my father had quite a number of bottles of Chateau Montelena, Zinfandel, and Cabernet Sauvignon from the 70s. And that's sort of what I learned tasting on. Mm-hmm. And in my tasting group that I've been going to since 1989, I've had the fortune of tasting that wine many times over. And it is one of the few wines that I regularly guess correctly in the blind tasting. because the wines were amazing, and that was an epiphany for me. You know, those Chateau Montelena Cabernets from the 70s.
Isn't that amazing? Because so much focus has been shifted to the 90s and 2000s, you know, kind of the rise of California cults, and that's what people kind of use as a point of reference in mm-hmm. a lot of cases. But in the 70s, there's some terrific stuff that was made way before it was famous. And longevity of those wines are really surprising.
Absolutely amazing. I think some of the wines that Randy Dunn was making in the 70s are amazing. And the other wines that I fell in love with during the same time frame when I was first graduating from college are the Ridge wines.
Classic.
And I've really been fortunate to be able to taste those same vintages over the last 30 plus years and enjoy them.
No, I mean, it sounds like you have a very broad perspective on both new and old world. So, you know, I think that's really the way to go, to the extent that you can, because I think it calibrates you differently.
I think it does. I think of our group of tasters here at the winery, I tend to like older wines more than probably the rest of the team. But I tend to drink older wines and stock my cellar so I can drink older wines. Mm-hmm. And when I first started really tasting blind in 89 with my tasting group, it was always 20, 25 years old, maybe 15 years old, mm-hmm. and very focused tastings. And we were tasting and still do taste from our friend's cellar and just reimburse him what he originally paid for the wine. And it's mm-hmm. been an amazing learning experience, but it also, because I'm not a winemaker, I don't taste every day mm-hmm. what's fresh and fermenting and so forth. Mm-hmm. I tend to taste things that are significantly older. And so I think your palate gets calibrated a little bit differently. I mean, obviously in the wine business, I do taste a lot of young wines and barrel samples now today, but my default is often older wines, and I definitely plan the cellar to enable us to keep drinking older wines.
But it was a process, you know, you learned yeah. where you lean, and it's so instructive what you're saying for, you know, those of you that are starting your journey or somewhere in the continuum. Taste. The more mm-hmm. you taste, the more you know.
Absolutely.
You've highlighted some mentorships throughout your career, specifically with respect to Coppola. Mm-hmm. Who has been the individuals that influenced you the most, professionally, personally?
Oh my goodness. Wow, there's so many. I mean, my entire team
generous.
Here,
yeah,
my entire
generous.
Team is teaching me something new yeah. every day. I mean, I like to work with people who know a lot more than I do, mm-hmm. and that kind of guarantees that I'll learn something new every day, so I like that. I was very fortunate to work for John Skepney, as I mentioned to you, and John was always so generous with his time with me, especially when I was very new. And then also Marianne Cuneo and Richard Cuneo working for them, and mm-hmm. Richard Conley on the professional side when I started at Sebastiani. He was the COO there, and he really taught me a lot about the business side and management of a large winery. Mm-hmm. It was great to work for. Always asking questions.
You know, your career just seems so perfect in so many ways. As I listen to you speak, and from, you know, I've known prior, it seems almost flawless.
Not really.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask. Has there been tough moments, things where you just, you know, didn't want to do this anymore, or something that was so frustrating that, you know, really affected you?
Hmm. I've never felt like I don't want to do this anymore. I mean, I love what I do. I, you know, I meet interesting people. I work with interesting people, and, you know, we have fun. We spend a lot of time together, and we work really hard. Mm-hmm. There's been, you know, I've sold several wineries and uh-huh. that and uh-huh. and purchased a winery, and when you're in the middle of a transaction and you're the only one who knows about that transaction, yeah. It can be challenging, because you've got to have your hat on. Okay, I'm running the business and keeping it moving forward this way, and in your other head, you're like, okay, and I'm selling this place. I may not have a job in 3 months, but yeah. And so it's sort of, you have to divide your focus. And, you know, I think that's actually one of the things that I'm very good at is, okay, I've got two paths and I'm running them both at full speed, but it can be pretty exhausting.
Yeah, so it's the taxing part is the mental, keeping everything.
Well, and not just the mental, but just the pure number of hours, because yeah. now you're doing two full-time jobs.
Yeah.
Right, and you have to keep everything running at its best and going towards that long-term goal. And you have to simultaneously keep the process secret and perform at a very high level. So your day job can't really suffer, but that's a very important part of what you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like you've navigated it well. You know.
Well, we sold everything that we were going to sell, so I guess that worked.
You know, in a sense, the wine, I should say Napa Valley, and the wine industry to some degree, kind of grew up in front of your eyes in its current iteration.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was visiting with some friends the other day, and my friend Natalie Delors, she said, how did we get to be the old guard? Remember when we were the young people in the industry?
Yes.
I said, yo, how did that happen?
Yeah.
I guess it's good. It beats the alternative.
Yeah. I'm curious what you've observed, even just in the last couple of decades, because there's so many changes that happened, and I can barely recognize the valley, and I'm just an observer. You were on the inside of this, so what what was it like for you, and what is the valley like then and now?
You know, I think for me, when I first started working here, I commuted from Oakland, and I commuted to Rutherford every day. And I would just look at the valley as I drove up and think, my God, this is the most beautiful place on earth, and it's so lovely. And I find myself doing that still today. I think that there's a lot that more that hasn't changed than has. And I think what has changed for me is there is definitely more traffic on the road. There's, in the city of Napa, there's not as much for locals, you know, in the downtown area as there used to be. And we have a lot more hotels and visitors, and the economy revolves around that. And I think that's been, you know, for the most part, good for our community. But also, I think the visitors who used to come would maybe try to see 10 or 12 wineries in a day. And the visitors who come today take it slowly, and they have an experience, and they see, you know, three wineries, and they have a nice lunch, and they go out to dinner, and they see a show, or they maybe go for a hike, and it's more of an experience. So there's more people here, but I think that they're delving more deeply into to what it is to make wine, to taste wine, and enjoying themselves and learning a little bit more than just kind of coming through and tasting.
Is there anything that concerns you about the future of Napa? I know there's a lot of conversation about land use and tourism and, you know, the cost of visiting, and those are the things that get brought up. And do you have any labor shortages, that sort of stuff?
Those are all big issues. And I think, you know, the fires, we lost a lot of housing in Napa that we couldn't afford to lose. And the cost to rebuild that housing and to provide housing for the people who are going to do the rebuilding, that's one of our greatest challenges, I think. I think we need a very global solution, or community global solution, to solve that problem in a creative manner. And I have a number of thoughts on that, but I think that's important. I think we need to think about the housing that we're building, and that housing being primary residences, not second residences. We can't afford to have a large volume of mid-priced homes for second homes here. We need homes for people who work here, and structuring an intelligent incentive around that to enable people to purchase where they work is important. So I think housing is probably our greatest issue. I think if we want to keep Napa Valley looking like it is, we are going to have an ongoing traffic problem. But with better public transportation, perhaps some alternate solutions, we can improve that. It's interesting. We're in a challenging position because people say, well, we've got too much. When you talk to the community, they look at the county and say, well, the county has too much traffic, too little housing. without the recognition that the cities are what needs to focus on the traffic and the housing, because the agricultural preserve is so large that the county mm-hmm. is not going to solve the housing mm-hmm. and traffic problem. The county and the cities need to work together mm-hmm. in an intelligent manner and think about, if we're going to build more hotels, mm-hmm. how many workers do you need per room in exactly. the hotels? How many visitors is that going to bring? What's the traffic component to that? And look beyond the revenue of the hotel business and look at the overall intelligent plan of the county mm-hmm. and cities together. We need to function as one government, not a mass of multiple cities and a county.
Just that kind of fracturing that's not mm-hmm. useful.
It's not, we're too small an area mm-hmm. to have so many competing interests.
Mm. See, I know you're very active. You were elected to Wine Council 3 years ago, I think, yeah.
Oh, I've been on the Wine Market Council board for a long time, and I was on the Napa Valley Vintners board for 6 years. Yeah. So I just rolled off. I was chair 3 years ago,
chair,
I think.
Yeah. Exactly, to be the chair.
Was it three?
To be specific.
Was it? I think it was 3 years ago. Yeah.
So that's a big responsibility as well. Is this the kind of issues that, kind of took center stage were discussed?
And I shouldn't say that I represent the vintner's opinion on that. Those opinions are all my own.
Yeah.
But yes, and I am still vocal on many and active in many committees, even though I have rolled off the board of the vintners I turned off at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, well, you're clearly very busy. That time management thing that we discussed earlier, I'm utterly fascinated because you have so many, formidable responsibilities. I don't know how you juggle it all.
Sometimes I wonder.
And speaking of that, again, going back to your career, and you've pretty much held very early on executive positions, which bear a ton of responsibility, and I don't want to make it about being a woman in the leadership position, but that's factually true. Do you think that there is any difference between a woman executive versus a man?
I think that men and women are different, and I think that the best companies are diverse, mm-hmm. and the best teams are diverse, whether it's male and female, and different ethnicity, different backgrounds, because everyone brings something new to the table. And any time that you have a group of people who are all the same, then you lose creativity. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I've been very fortunate to work for men and women, but mainly for men during a large portion of my wine career, who treat me as an intelligent person who's doing a good job and can do, and can grow. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been fortunate to work for smart people who weren't focused on, well, you're a woman or you're a man mm-hmm. or whatever. I think that they recognize me for working hard and doing a good job. And I think that if we all focus on doing our best every day mm-hmm. and being respectful of everyone we work with and having that diverse environment, then that is more a recipe for success than saying, oh, I'm a woman and, I'm whatever, I'm the first one to do this or that. I think that, the greatest compliment is you're good at what you do, and that's what we all strive for. I was hosting a group at the US Open Women's Finals, and when they introduced Serena Williams, they said, and here is Serena Williams, one of the greatest athletes of all time. And I really noticed that they didn't say one of the greatest female athletes, mm-hmm. because she is truly one of the greatest athletes of all time. And I think that that's an extra nod of respect when you put aside that, oh, he's the first black president, she's the first female winemaker. She's mm-hmm. the, you know, he, you need to just, it's the person. He's a great president.
Yeah.
She's a great winemaker. It's not about what color they are or just because she's a woman. It's, you know.
Thank you for saying that. I think it's such an important sentiment because, again, what's being paid attention to currently is a little concerning because there's that labeling going on. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's healthy. I think it should be about your own capacity as a human being and your talents. And to your point, also who you surround yourself with. You said earlier that you always wanted to work with smart people. You surrounded yourself with the type of talent that you could learn from and grow. And that should be the focus, not the gender or any other orientation or any other labels that could be assigned.
And I think if you consciously hire the best person for the job mm-hmm. each time, then you end up with a diverse group.
Yeah.
I mean, California, we are a diverse community.
Mm-hmm. So I'm picturing this young woman listening that maybe is in college and, you know, is kind of wrestling with some choices and you know, may not know about you, but after this podcast, clearly, I would imagine she'd be pretty impressed with not just the career that you crafted, but the point of view. What advice would you give to her?
I think, you know, work for kind, smart people who want to share their knowledge and want you to succeed. And work hard and do your best. And, you know, for me, it's always do the right thing. Because whenever there's a shortcut or you don't make that right choice, you'll regret it.
It's the hardest thing to do, usually. It's the right thing. So whenever you start justifying, that's right. The wrong path.
I know. And you know, sometimes, you know, that's why I'm here, because my team will say, well, you know, I could just do this, or we could do this. And I'm like, yeah, so you're going to do the harder method because that's actually the right way to do it, right? And I said, yes, but, you know, I just wanted to ask.
I love that. That means consciousness. Sometimes when you just actually articulate it to someone, it helps, right?
It does. Because sometimes you think, oh, you know, if I just took this shortcut, it would be so much easier in my day. And then you think about it like, yeah, but will I make the very best at the end of the day? No.
Yeah.
So.
That's a good litmus test. Is there something that's really close, near and dear to your heart? You know, maybe a charity cause or maybe something that you really feel strongly about. So if I were to wave a magic wand and get the world to stop and just listen to you, what would you say?
Oh my, wow. Birth control for all?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be probably.
You feel it's really important to kind of control the...
I do. I think that when a woman in any country has the ability to control her reproductive rights, she has the ability to control the care of her family and the care of herself
mm-hmm.
and make the world a better place.
Well, in that sense, the notion of a woman as a mom, as, you know, as a citizen, as all the roles that she inhabits, what you're describing is her being more in control of how her future is shaped.
I think just access to birth control
mm-hmm.
on a global basis is super important. There's wonderful organizations like Engender Health mm-hmm. that do that on a global scale, mm-hmm. and they change communities for the better.
Wow.
And they extend women's lives.
Well, that's really important.
Right.
And I assume that this is something you support, you know.
Absolutely.
And this is a passion of yours. Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been an honor and a pleasure to sit down with you this morning and get to know you and the things that I think we all care about, whether we consciously realize it or not. I think that a lot of what you touched upon are monumental and fundamental wisdoms and touchstones that we all need to think about, and hopefully over a glass of wine. Thank you again, and this has been Palate Exposure. Goodbye.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.